The Rufus Project would like to advise the following podcast contains spoilers for Hudson Hawk from 1991. If you do not wish to have this movie spoilt, please watch it before listening to the following podcast. Is it a comedy caper about colourful criminals stealing classic art, or is its appeal as mysterious as Mona Lisa's smile? We watched Hudson Hawk from 1991 to see if we could redeem it. Were we successful? Find out after the theme.
Boy? Oh boy.
Is it too good to be bad? So bad it's good. What's this movie? Do you think we should? It's got bad. I love dodgy creatures, but we want to know what the redeeming features.
Boy?
Hello and welcome to the Rufus Project Redeeming Features cast, this time focusing on Hudson Hawk from 1991. I am one of your hosts, Trevor Holland, and I am joined by my good friend and co-host,
Christian Fletcher. Thank you, Trevor. And may I say, I'm looking forward to swooping in on this movie, Hudson Hawk. Yeah, I thought I'd throw a bit of a pun in there. So thanks for having me along.
Oh, my pleasure. I'm glad you came back. I always worry sometimes when we select a movie, if somebody doesn't like it enough, they may not come back. But we keep motoring on and we keep pushing on. And I'm not making any comments about this movie at this time, but I know we've had some doozies in the past. So it's always good that we can keep soldiering on and approaching each new one with enthusiasm and, probably a slight bit of madness.
And I honestly couldn't think of a better candidate for both of those categories in terms of a film. So, yep, but I don't want to give too much away, of course, as I always seem to early on.
Fair enough. Well, we probably should get straight into it. Now, this was my suggestion, so whatever the outcome is, the listeners can blame me, but we probably should let people know what Hudson Hawk is about. And I've grabbed this little synopsis from the internet. An ex-cat burglar, played by Bruce Willis, sets out to steal a series of priceless artifacts in this globe-spanning caper.
Well, I suppose that's it in a nutshell, you know, and this the last part of it?
Globe-spanning caper.
Oh, okay, yes, I can see that, even though going from, you know, America to Rome isn't exactly global, but yeah, okay, it sums it up quite well. And having known nothing about Hudson Hawk, I would have known this was going in, didn't know it was going to kind of be following this format. I was expecting, you know, Bruce Willis having done a lot of these action films, you know, and in the early 90s, him still sort of being known for that. It was, definitely an interesting film. But being a cult movie exhibitor, I get a lot of requests for this movie. When I say a lot, I'm probably exaggerating. I've had a couple over the years. But so I was actually interested to see this. But gosh, did this have cult movie written all over it?
Yeah, I mean, you can certainly see where it can have that cult movie appeal. But yeah, as we know, sometimes cult doesn't equate to good, but we shall see where we go. Now, I have dug up some turkey trivia for this one, of course. It's rated 5.7 out of 10 on IMDb. It had a budget of around $65 million, and its box office takings were a whopping $17
million. Oh, gosh. Well, I'm even baffled at where that $65 million went, but there were some quite impressive / expensive explosions happening in the movie. But, gosh, I would never have said $65 million. And, yeah, so $15 million or $16 million it made back.
Oh, 17. Close enough.
17. Oh, it was close, wasn't I? How quickly we forget. But I don't know. Do you remember it coming out in cinemas at all around the time? I don't know if it got sort of – it was a bit of a sleeper movie or –
I've only seen this movie a couple of times a long time ago, and I only really caught it, at kind of like a Sunday afternoon cult movie matinee screening of a couple of movies, at the screening of a now sadly gone cinema, that I used to live near at the time. So I don't remember its original release or what its original reception was in Australia. But certainly making back less than a third of its budget, I guess, yeah, it didn't really come out to great fanfare or success.
Yeah, and I think, not that I can think of many off the top of my head, but I know we have touched on movies in the past where we've found that maybe these whole madcap comedy capers that try and feature probably, I suppose you could say, an ensemble cast can be very hit and miss, and that's probably what I'd put Hudson Hawk in the category of, because look at what a cast list. It just kept coming. Even ones that weren't even in the opening credits, I still kept spotting so many different people throughout this film.
Yeah, definitely has got quite an impressive cast. I mean, as I touched on last week last time when I announced we were going to look at this, of course, Bruce Willis is in there, Danny Aiello, Andy McDowell, James Coburn, Richard E. Grant, Sandra Bernhardt, David Caruso, Frank Stallone, who we actually recently saw in a redeeming features movie not too long ago, I believe. So quite the cast list. That is definite.
That's interesting, because the whole time I was watching it, I'm going, oh, Richard E. Grant, because I kept thinking that we'd seen him in Mystery Men, but I'm actually thinking, believe it or not, of Spice World, the movie that unfortunately I'd seen recently. And it felt very much that he was following the same sort of style and camping it up as always, which he seems to be quite good at.
Yeah, we'll get into Richard E. Grant, I think, a bit more as we go on, but there was no doubt he was having fun. You can't take that away from him.
Oh, for sure.
but if we move on to a bit of trivia, Hudson Hawk was the first and final foray into screenwriting of actor Bruce Willis, who received a story credit for the movie.
Oh, okay. So I'm wondering if the result of the film deterred him from future projects.
Yeah, well, I think maybe some of the things with the film that we may talk about later may also come from the fact that there were frequent on-set script rewrites as a result of Bruce Willis throwing ideas around.
And you do wonder, too, yeah, how much of this actually, it affected the movie in the long run, or actually, worked out for the positive. But I wouldn't be surprised if it added to the insanity that it sounds like was happening behind screen as well as on.
Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, Bruce certainly probably used it to have a bit of fun and say a few things he wanted to say. Apparently, when Bruce Willis's character says to one of the mafia guys, directions even your brother can understand, not only is he referring to the character in the movie, but allegedly he's also making a dig at co-star Frank Stallone's very famous brother, Sylvester.
Aha. So, and that's the thing. I get the feeling it's a movie very full on with in-jokes, and I don't want to, again, spoil too much, but yeah, it feels like a film very much on with, that sort of tongue-in-cheek humour, and yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if things like that are in there, but it was quite, probably the first thing that struck me was it was quite unusual seeing Bruce Willis in quite a reversal role. I think I was actually watching it with a friend, and the first thing he said was, oh wow, it's so weird seeing him as at the start, sort of not a bad guy, but going, I suppose, the angle of the cat burglar, I suppose. And yeah, so it was quite different for him. So this was probably him in the early 90s trying to try a few different projects.
Yeah, well, I didn't write down all the references, but looking through the trivia, there was quite a few references to things thrown in there that referenced other Bruce Willis movies and other James Coburn movies and little nods to stuff that a lot of the actors had done previously, just sprinkled throughout, either as the name of someone or just, some offhand line. They certainly did throw in, I suppose, a few knowing winks to those who may, enjoy the various people that were performing in this movie.
Definitely. And it was very full on with those sort of visual sight gags and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, we will touch on that.
Yeah, well, we'll get off Bruce Willis for a bit, because obviously another, I suppose, very noticeable person in this movie is Richard E. Grant. And when UK movie critic Mark Kermode met Richard E. Grant, he told him that he was one of the few people who liked Hudson Hawk. Grant responded by saying it was a stinking pile of steaming hot donkey droppings, and you are an idiot.
Yeah, yet again, as we said earlier, Richard E. Grant seems to me the one that stands out as the one camping it up the most. So he must have known what he was signing up for and really just wanted that paycheck. But interesting to hear that. I have heard that quote before, but I actually thought it was in reference to another one of his movies. Hey, he could bring it out a couple of times.
Yeah, yep. He's got quite an interesting catalogue of movies under
his belt. Yeah, definitely, which I'm sure we will get to at some stage with the redeeming features in years
quite
to come.
Quite possibly. and also, because he appeared quite a lot with another character, and so from that, Richard E. Grant and Sandra Bernhard apparently got on very, very well and are still good friends to this very day. Aww.
Oh, interesting. Oh, and Sandra Bernhardt, God, I knew from this period as being sort of Madonna's best friend. That was around the time of, you know, the Madonna had that controversial documentary, you know, Embedded with Madonna, and this was around that period. And, I've never really sort of taken her serious as an actress as such, and so it was hard the whole time. Like, I have seen her in other things where she's acted, I suppose, well or you know, passable, but it was hard the whole time in this, whether to know it was part of the actual character or whether that was actually just how she can act, but it worked. It definitely lent itself to her being a villainess, I suppose. Very much, it sort of was reminiscent of Parker Posey in Josie and the Pussycats. I think that was one of the movies we looked at.
Sure. Well, yeah. Well, Richard and Sandra certainly, I guess you could say, their performances kind of matched each other. Let's just leave it at that for now.
Yeah, definitely. They look like they were having a ball, and that's the main thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And just touching on what you mentioned earlier with, I suppose, you know, seeing Bruce Willis in this sort of role, because even though the film is a comedy, it was marketed as an action film due to the presence of Bruce Willis, particularly because it was following on from the success of Die Hard 2, which was released in 1990.
Ah, see, I really didn't realise it was that soon to it. I see. I think I might be wrong, but I'm sure I read something that, yeah, it was originally promoted in posters with some title, and then they had to change it to, yeah, reflect action and adventure rather than the previous way they'd promoted it. And, I suppose to some extent I'm sure there would have been people that were happy. You know, there was elements of action, but I think going into it as thinking it was a Bruce Willis typical action vehicle, you would have been probably a bit upset.
Yeah, I can imagine if it was not marketed correctly, there would have been a lot of very unhappy people in the audience.
But I do think this would have been a movie that would, or probably is to this day, still very hard to find its audience. So, it's definitely got a lot of different things going for it. So, yep, and Bruce Willis just adding to the mystery of, or the confusion of the whole thing, I think.
Possibly. before we go too much more into that, again, we can't help ourselves, can we, Christian? One of these days we will learn control.
I know. Too much to say.
Too eager to talk about these things. So we need to set our baseline, Christian. We've got to set that baseline. I've kind of found one. It's very, very brief, but pretty much, I've gone to Amazon to try to find a review that, I suppose sets a tone and really, says it all for those not so favorable reviews where we see what we're working from in our attempts to redeem these movies. The title of this review is simply Unspeakably Awful. Unspeakably Awful. The plot is worse than a Scooby-Doo episode. The script is horrible. Bruce Willis is irritatingly smirky and smug. I'm ashamed to have spent $3.99 of renting this. 1 star.
Oh. Well, yeah, as you say, it can only go up or plateau from there. So let's just see if we got our $3.99 worth from this movie. So, okay, let's see how we go. But that pretty much sums it up.
Indeed. So, again, as is my wont, before I pressed play, I made sure I checked the running length. And I thought, yeah, 1 hour 39, this shouldn't be too torturous.
Yeah, but, you know, and should be fairly breezy. And, yeah, I'm glad that we're finally, you know, picking things that are more of a more generous length. So, yeah, so that worked for me. But, I don't know. I don't know if it was when you mentioned it a couple of weeks, you know, when we were talking about Hudson Hawk. I don't know if you'd mentioned something about it being very comic book or cartoon style. But you know, as soon as that opening shot of the storybook opening, I'm like, ah, something sprang to mind. I'm like, Trevor did say something about this. So I'm like, suddenly you're thinking, are we going to be taken on a once upon a time journey a la, I don't know, Princess Bride?
Yeah, it was like, yeah, very, very fairy tale with the book opening and giving us the narration by William Conrad. Very familiar sounding voice. Often, I think, in those sort of story tale style narration roles, very sing-songy voice as he takes us through a story of Leonardo da Vinci trying to turn lead into bronze, but turning it into something else instead.
Yes, and what I realised with this scene too, I wouldn't be surprised if people even walked out during this scene thinking they'd walked into the wrong movie, because I'd almost for a while there thought, oh, is this Hudson Hawk? Am I watching the right thing? Because immediately, we're in, I can't remember what the year was, it 1800 something, or it might have even been earlier than that. But it seemed like a very steampunk-esque world that they were in, very much more advanced than I expected for that period. But, you know, you were sort of, you know, were we watching Baron Munchausen or you know, some sort of fantasy film? So it was definitely an interesting way to open the film.
Yeah, it certainly had that feeling, especially when you got to look at the machine and just how involved it was. And you had people jumping off ledges, pulling down ropes, and horses pulling things around to set up this great experiment by Leonardo da Vinci, who then walks off and they throw in a few more gags. I mean, I thought the Mona Lisa gag was kind of all right.
Yeah, well, when things like that happen, I thought as soon as that happened, I thought they're going to throw puns and all sorts of things like that and sight gags into the rest of the movie. So it kind of thankfully set the bar early on, because I think something like that a bit later would have been a bit random. But I was saying how the technology seemed quite advanced, but it's really hard for me to question anything when they've got that, all I call it, the spiky object or the star or whatever that's, you know, you do realize that this, you know, that it's quite, you know, fantastical, you know, like, so you're kind of, you know, prepared that what you're seeing isn't quite real. So especially when they start, as you said, you know, inventing and creating all these weird inventions.
Indeed. So, we get to see Leonardo. It was a very strange-looking Leonardo. I've just got to say that.
That's what I was thinking. And I don't even know if it was played by one of the people like Richard E. Grant or someone that comes in later, because I was trying to pinpoint them the whole time.
No, that was Stefano Molinari, I think so. That was his only credited appearance in the movie.
Oh, I'm sure he was happy to be in that. So, okay, not a famous person like I was thinking, but I was glad to know that once I'd realised that this was going to be just the setup for what is going to be happening in present day. I'm glad that we are then, you know, transported into present day, and thankfully the movie sort of has that, sort of starts picking up the pace, which, you know, thankfully got my attention straight away.
Yeah, the quick banter certainly doesn't waste much time right from where Hudson, or Bruce Willis, probably just use the character name, Hudson is getting out of jail, and he has his banter with the guy signing him out, and then he has his banter with the parole officer who's trying to already get him to do another job, but he just wants to go straight.
And in the meantime, it's happening like as in sort of like one continuous shot. Yeah, as you said, like he's walking and doing all this sort of stuff. So yeah, the pace is sort of kept up straight away, and it's actually a good way for them to reveal the plot. Or not plot, you know, we're giving a pretty good way, setting up the movie quite well and not wasting too much time. And even early on, I sort of get this, I even said to my friend that I was watching it with, I'm like, there's something about no one wants this guy to drink cappuccino. And then as we see later on, it does become sort of, again, one of those running gags in the movie.
Yeah, I do remember there was like a promo or a trailer which actually, so like harped on like all he wanted was a cappuccino. But yeah, that cappuccino gag, it kind of, yeah, they threw it in a few times and then kind of let it go for a while and then threw it in again a couple of times and then let it go again. They didn't let the gag get old, but it certainly wasn't all that consistent. Yeah, this guy just can't drink his cappuccino.
Especially not enough to warrant putting it in the trailer. Hey, that might have been just one of those other quirky ways that they thought they could promote the film as well.
Yeah, I think, you know, I just want to say, hey, this is a different sort of Bruce Willis movie. Maybe it was before they decided to promote it as an action movie in order to make sure they got the Bruce Willis fans on board.
It could be a movie for the coffee set, so, or the cafe set, so. But at least the good thing about this, with the whole him going out of jail and being asked to do sort of another crime again, you know, we definitely, we're set up the whole sort of, I don't know if the term heist movie, I suppose, yeah, it is, I suppose, the term, you know, we're originally sort of, yeah, we're initially sort of set up this sort of heist movie, which sort of, you know, definitely got my interest, because I'm like, oh, wow, it's going to be a movie about cat burglary and art heists. So, yeah, it kind of, so I was really excited to see what happened. And of course, as we said, it didn't waste much time because, you know, whilst he doesn't drink his cappuccino, he also has, I believe, oh, actually, it is the cappuccino that gets smashed, I think. I think that's the first thing that gets shot in front of him and we're plunged straight in the deep end.
Yeah, and this is probably where I found that, the tone, I suppose, comes from those ideas being thrown around even while the film was being shot. Because the whole meeting with the Mario brothers, there's a few Nintendo references in there as well.
I had a bit of a chuckle.
It's part, you know, obviously played for laughs, but then it also gets quite serious, especially afterwards where Hudson and, Tommy played by Danny Aiello are at the back talking about it and, They just go dead serious for a period of time, before, you know, starting to joke with each other again. I'm thinking, okay, hang on, what tone is this movie going for? You know, because you can kind of, you know, obviously have your serious bits, but it was just such a sharp change of the tone that, like, even though, you know, it had been quite fast paced up to that point, was quite jarring, given all the banter and little jabs and jibes and jokes directed at each other up to that point.
And you wonder if it was more a matter of that sort of seriousness was more what the original script was like and the other stuff was more what Bruce or other characters are added in or, you know, or vice versa. But, yeah, it definitely, it sort of set up straight away that we knew the tone of this movie was just going to change continually. And again, that it went through in my mind again, is this supposed to be sort of a comic book adaptation or something like that? Because, you know, again, with that whole book thing, so it's supposed to, is it supposed to feel like little individual stories? So it's just, you know, you'd notice there was a lot of times when, and I don't know if this is classed as clever or just downright weird, but there was a lot of those editing shots where he'd be, I don't know, running to find, to I can't remember the example, but running to go into a room and the next thing when they fall through a roof and then the next thing they're actually in the room itself, and it's a good way to sort of segue into the next scene. So a lot of that stuff was happening that was quite confusing. But yeah, I think that was all sort of trying to set up, this is like all these madcap adventures in the day of the life of this guy. But yeah, I'm probably reading too much into it. The tone just, yeah, was not consistent.
Yeah, it certainly, yeah, I don't know if they were going for the comic book feel, but I'm guessing that was the intent, even though I don't believe this is based on any particular comic book. It was just, you know, one of the things I did read was that it was essentially put together so that Bruce Willis and Danny Aiello could work together because they had been wanting to do so for a number of years. And that was one of the prime reasons this got done.
Well, you having said that, you can definitely tell the chemistry between the two of them anyway. You could, you know, it really gave off that feeling of a real buddy film, you know. And I think, you know, like I was saying about, it being quite madcap and I suppose unusual, but I suppose that they were really going for more that sort of, yeah, that slapstick style. That was quite a thing that happened quite a lot. You know, there was that, you know, when they went, when he was, you know, I think it was the first burglary, when he did the whole, hitting the cops' heads together with the doing, you know, like the, you know, the real sort of Three Stooges or Keystone Cops type style. So yeah, that was running through, and I think that's a lot where that cartoony feel, you know, was always, hit home.
Yeah, but don't just jump straight through to that part of the heist, because you're missing a very, I suppose, one of the characteristic peculiarities of this movie. So in the lead up to the heist, they keep, Tommy keeps yelling out song names, and Hudson replies with how long they go for. All leading up to them getting in, they've been essentially extorted to do this heist to steal this this horse, this little statue of a horse from an auction house, and they work out how long it's going to take, and go off and proceed to what I suppose you can say is have a musical heist.
It's just, oh, it was so, how clever is that though? Like, what a way to, what an ingenious way to time a burglary though, like. And the thing is, that's what I was confused about, because the song that they were, I assume it's an old standard, but the song that they were doing, I assume it was actually Bruce Willis's, it was their voices, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
I'm fairly sure.
Another thing that Bruce Willis, I think, was trying to do around the time was also have a musical career. He did actually release a few cover versions, which did so-so in the charts.
Yeah, I do remember. I think I actually have had people request a couple of, an 80s or 90s night. So, yeah, they are unfortunately out there. So, yeah, I thought that actually too when I was seeing this. So, yeah, it managed to work, but I thought, oh, is this setting us up for a possible musical film? Like, is this going to continue throughout? So, but yeah, very, very clever way of actually burglaring a place.
Yeah, but again, like, you know, it was such a focus on the song names and the length and this, yeah, this choreographed musical heist. But then they don't really use it again until much later on in the movie, even though Bruce does, I suppose, undergo a few capers in the interim.
Yeah, and that's what I thought was strange too. Like, I thought it was going to become a thing, like, you know, kind of a real big plot device for the rest of the film. But yeah, again, like a lot of the other ideas, they sort of come and go, and again, a lot to do with possibly the amount of ideas that were being thrown on the table when they were filming. So
I don't know. There's pretty much not much we can say about that. Yeah, they do this heist whilst singing "Swinging on a Star," I believe was the song. They have this clever thing where they mess with the tapes and overlook the fact that a chair broke just as they were getting there. And so when they mess with the tapes and show previous footage, the chair's back in place, which is what gets them undone and get the guards turned up so they can bang their heads together with the boink sound.
And it's like, how cliche did it have to be? You've always got the two bumbling, you know, security guards who are too busy, you know, not paying attention, and then you've got the, what do they say, Fat Stan, the security guard. Like, they were just trying to throw every bloody cliche they could, you know, into it. But of course, as you said, just to set up the fact that, you know, for later on, the fact that these guys weren't paying attention. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it seemed very obvious. But hey, it was that sort of film. But
well, it didn't shy away from stereotypes, because once they did finish the heist and they go, and yeah, Bruce Willis falls through a canopy and then lands in the chair in the living room of these stereotypical Italian mobsters. The stereotype English posh guy turns up who has swords up his sleeves or something. Very, very strange. And then we get our first bit of, I suppose, full-on violence as he runs one of the Italian guys through, which doesn't really seem to concern the other ones all that much.
Yeah, and that's one thing, you even just you touching on that. Yeah, the violence doesn't exactly hold back, you know. It is very quick to the point, but at least, yeah, then setting a standard for the rest of the film as well too. But yeah, again, something that was fitting in possibly as Bruce Willis-like as they could.
Yeah, again, yeah, the change of tone. And so when it comes to the next morning, they're back at Tommy's bar, and there's this giant, I'm assuming it's the cappuccino machine that blows up, so Bruce Willis still can't get his cappuccino. And he ends up heading back to this auction house because the headlines of the newspaper say that there was an attempt to steal this horse, but it wasn't stolen and it was still on sale.
Ooh.
Intrigue.
Yes, and we know we're about to go into the next section, and what I assume is then going to be the sort of the crux of the entire film, especially with the, I think, is this the first time we see Andy McDowell, I think, as the, I suppose I've got here her as an art expert. I suppose that's probably not really the term for her.
Yeah, yeah, so, yeah, Bruce Willis turns up at this auction and sits next to Andy McDowell and starts flirting with her and basically saying the wrong things, but in such a charming, comical way. What a scamp. Until the point where she gets up and is introduced as the expert from the Vatican on the works of Leonardo da Vinci, and she verifies that the horse is indeed the genuine article when we all know it's not.
But I love how even she doesn't even really look at it that much. She just sort of holds it and just sort of, I don't know, it's like it's putting a spell on her. And that's, again, I'm thinking, oh, is this going to be some link to that very first scene with the crystal and all that sort of thing. So, but yeah, she didn't really give it too much of a look over, but hey, she was convinced.
And then we get to see, again, like the stuff that just gets thrown in there in advance with no explanation. It almost like sets stuff up. Well, we'll throw something in, but does the setup after the fact. So Bruce Willis is looking around the auction room, and there's these various, just some very out of place looking people, all eating different chocolate bars. And you get, okay, and then we get to meet the Mayflowers, who come storming in, Richard E. Grant and Sandra Bernhard as Darwin and Minerva Mayflower.
That's their names. Yeah.
They go from 0 to 100 just from the word go. There's certainly no subtlety in their performance.
Oh God, if they really just charge in, and if the movie had been filmed in order, it was almost like they felt by this stage they really just needed to come in and inject some more life into it or something like that. But yeah, no, even my friend that I was watching with said, oh my God, what the hell is she? Because, yeah, Sandra Bernhard just comes in and just, you know, chews up scenery just like, I don't know, like she's trying to star in Mummy Dearest or something. So, yeah, but I did, and you were mentioning about the chocolate bars. It was funny because when the first guy, you know, you see him with the Snickers, I'm like going, oh God, that was really blatantly obvious product placement there. Then I'm like, oh, duh, of course, that's what they're trying to go for. They're establishing their name. Yes. So, again, why was I questioning things in this movie? It just seemed to be that kind of movie where they'd throw in everything plus the kitchen sink and hope it sticks.
And then we get one of those just sudden changes in tone. So as the Mayflowers come in and bid $1,000,001, and the auctioneer brings the gavel down, we're subjected to a very big explosion. And again, very dramatic and very sudden after just all this like, you know, comic style banter and over the top performances. Suddenly, oh look, more sudden violence out of nowhere to just be jarring.
And it's like they've edited all the action or sort of explosive scenes like that together and then just sort of scatter them through and hope they all work. And I swear at one stage I saw a head actually explode. Obviously, not for real, but, you know, in the film. But and I'm like going, I don't know, anything's possible in this movie. So, yeah, that explosion was something quite unexpected.
Yeah, but they use it for the chance for Hudson to save Andy McDowell's character. Anna, I believe was her name, from being squashed by a falling pillar, and as they're having their little post-rescue banter, he cops a Pegasus in the face.
So he pegs it gets pegged in the face, so that's very, very appropriate. And I think, I can't even, God, I've already slipped up, so we wake, I think the next part where he wakes up, God, I can't even remember.
I think so, he wakes up in the ambulance.
Oh, that's right, because we're about to have the very interesting scene, the scene with him flying out the back doors, which I think, I don't know if I've seen reference to in other films, or not other films, but over the years, I don't know, I don't know if it's an iconic scene, I don't know if any scene from this movie is iconic, but yeah, it definitely seemed very familiar. But yeah, so he goes from being the passenger in an ambulance to pretty much hanging on for dear life on the stretcher, I think with a sheet hanging from the back of the ambulance.
Yeah. So he gets threatened by the mafia guys in the back of the ambulance, which again gets a bit dark and a bit nasty until he fills one of their faces with syringes, which looked unpleasant. And then, yeah, comes goes flying out of the back of the ambulance on the gurney and is being pulled along behind it across what's, I believe, is meant to be the Brooklyn Bridge. Weaving in and out of traffic, a couple of girls mm-hmm. drive up beside him and just go, "Hey, are you gonna die?" Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, again, not knowing its tone, but he's probably thinking to himself, yeah, I probably am at the moment, but it's not helping. But
and then, yeah, because of the whole traffic going everywhere, he ends up overtaking the ambulance, so there ends up being this strange chase between him and this ambulance, and he's got to fling some coins into a toll booth to make sure he gets through in time, and...
It just seemed like it just kept going for ages and ages.
Yeah, so. It was quite... when you think about the scene and when it was made, it was obviously very meticulously choreographed and controlled.
And perhaps contributing to that really expensive budget, yeah.
Yeah, the ambulance ends up flipping off the road and exploding into a fireball, and he rolls straight into the midst of James Coburn as George Kaplan. And his CIA friends, who we saw previously, known as Snickers, Kit Kat, Butterfingers, and Almond Joy.
Oh my god. And let's just say Butterfingers is probably, let's just say the size of the guy is not what you'd expect for someone called Butterfingers. So they've definitely gone with the very typical thing that a lot of cliche things they do in the sort of gangster movies, so.
Yeah, but then we get introduced to Butterfingers as he's coming out of a portaloo and gets his jacket caught in the door, causing it to collapse behind him, and everyone going, ooh, like something nasty came out. Yeah.
Yeah, again, one of those other things that they've just added in there, and you almost think, like, you know, these ideas that the cast members were just coming up with, and we'll just throw that in for fun.
Yeah, again, it's hard to know what was planned and what was put in as a, hey, this will be a good moment.
Yeah, I don't know if any of them were considering if these are going to be good moments. I think they just, yeah, they just went with it. I don't know if it was, there was a part where, I don't know if it was around that part there where we actually, the cars collide or they end up, and there's actually a part where it ends up in the background, the sign is Collisionville, and I'm like, I can't even remember what part that was, I think it was in there, and I'm like, oh, they're really going now for the sight gags as well, so you really had to keep watching to see how many things they were throwing in with this, and how many of them actually were references to other things.
I didn't notice that one, but yeah, by this stage you did realize that this was a movie where they were throwing as much as they could at the wall to see what would stick, and that subtlety was not going to be a feature of this movie.
Definitely, but I must admit, you know, because I think it was from here that he has to go and steal the book or the, I don't know, they refer to it as the code, but I don't know is it supposed to actually be the Da Vinci Code or such, I don't know, but they're trying to be getting this book, but I really thought it was quite ingenious the ways that he was coming up with to capture it by going in and sort of sussing out the security beforehand, especially using that girl's stuffed animal, I mean elephant or whatever, to try and activate the security cage. But yeah, I thought that was quite interesting that he was, you know, it was quite ingenious, and then obviously plotting to do the actual crime.
Indeed, which was another thing, like with the whole CIA agents and their chocolate code names being thrown in there before it got set up. Like he's coming down the staircase into where Da Vinci's notebook or whatever it was being kept, and there's just this random child beating her stuffed elephant mercilessly against the banister, and you're going, that's rather odd, but, you know, it's kind of, again, like, he gets the elephant later on to set off the alarm system, so it's like, okay, just some random thing that just becomes relevant a bit later on. Yeah.
Yeah, and you just think to yourself, if that elephant hadn't been there, what would he have used? But it all happened again so quickly, he just throws it and, you know, obviously it sets the alarm off. But then I didn't realise that Andy McDowell's character had actually seen him throw it. Well, obviously, she would have seen him throw it because he was probably more throwing it because the little girl was annoying him. But yeah, again, well, pretty much straight away she's, I suppose, in on it. And I thought this is going to sort of ramp things up a bit, and she's going to become maybe an accomplice with his, you know, his heist.
Yeah, I don't know if she saw him because she was being a tour guide or something at the time, but she pretty much automatically assumes that he's the one that did it. And they make a few references to Bobo the elephant being quite the scamp or whatever. But then, as the alarms are going off and some sort of gas is being released, she takes him down official Vatican post mini railway thing that the two lackeys that the bad guys sent to keep an eye on him get stopped from going in there, but he's just allowed to walk straight in with Andy McDowell. Oh, we probably also have skipped over the fact that we've already seen the villain's supervillain lair at this stage. They're building with a giant M on the front where they hold court in a rather over-the-top camp scenery-chewing fashion.
Yeah, of course. You know, in true villain fashion anyway. Like, they're definitely taking that with two hands and grabbing and shaking it.
Indeed. And, but yeah, and as he heads off and he makes a date with her after a bit of, again, fun banter. Another strange thing happens where she turns to a crucifix and starts talking to this crucifix as if she's making some sort of confession, and it lights up and a voice comes out of it, which turns out to be some Vatican priest who's part of a Vatican spy network or something. It never really got explained, that side of it.
Oh, I know. I'm glad that we finally worked out there was an intercom, because again, you know how I said earlier when she was touching the lion or the horse, and she sort of seemed like this strange magic came over. Again, I thought this was one of those things that, is this woman supposed to have some sort of magical power? Why is that crucifix lighting up? And is that just a really bad special effect? And as we realise, it's an intercom. And yeah, you don't know whether it's considered kind of, I don't know, blasphemous in a way, but yeah, it was an interesting way of using it, let's just say.
And again, like I said, it's one of those gags that gets set up and isn't really used all that much more. Yeah, so I'm just trying to think. So he gets out of there. He tries to call Tommy, and the CIA team turn up again. And this is where we find out that they're working with the Mayflowers because they know all about the heist to try to steal the book and move his timetable up. I'm just trying to think, so...
I know, it just seems to be... Honestly, it ended up just becoming a blend. I mean, heist after heist, or attempted or failed heist after heist. Though it is quite easy to get confusing. And I know that towards the end, it started to get quite crazy. So it's easy for us to have been quite confused about really what happened next. But I've pretty much got here that we've got to the demise of the bad guys. But I think I'm way ahead of myself.
You're definitely way ahead of it.
Yeah, exactly. Wrong column.
So he has this chat with the CIA team. As he walks off, we get to see the Kit Kat character, who doesn't actually talk and holds up cards instead of words, but they always seem to be relevant. And he's dressed as Hudson, imitating him from behind, until Hudson gives him a little elbow in the nose as part of it. And since it gives him a little card warning him about a blue wire, and we get to see the whole heist of stealing Da Vinci's book from this museum, and his escape over the rooftops, including a nice little gag of the bag with the book hanging off an antenna, and we cut to the Pope hitting his TV with his staff because the reception's not very good.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I loved that. That was... See, even he watches TV too, so... But yeah, so again, this sort of thing, I think there were so many moments where I did laugh out loud, and that was probably one of those moments, because I don't know if it was all just in the ridiculousness of it all, but yeah, it definitely, and that was the tone it really should have maintained the entire way through, is that kind of slapstick. It was, as you were saying, when we get to those sort of darker things, that you got a bit sort of, bit lost, but yeah, that was what you were expecting more from it, that real slapstick caper movie.
Yeah, indeed, and, but anyway, so he manages to escape, and he falls on the back of a chicken truck and falls off and lands in a chair right where Andy McDowell is waiting for him for the dinner date they set up. Again, just this madcap series of events that just ends up with him being exactly where he needs to be.
Yep, exactly. You know, still not getting a cappuccino, I might add, but he has got a date with Annie McDowell.
He does, and the CIA is at a nearby table, just having a sequence where they show how dumb Butterfingers is, because he wants French fries, because he thinks he's in France instead of Italy. Oh, it's hilarious.
Oh, I know. And it's almost like it's like that to give the characters something more to do, or as you said, showing that they were dumb. But yeah, I think we've kind of established that you've followed every other cliche and trope that, that usually these guys are bumbling, you know, sidekicks. But yeah, we don't really need, we didn't need an explanation. But it seems to be that, you know, that's the thing. This movie just throws so many scenes in, whether they're consistent or not.
Yeah, I mean, really, at this point, I was wondering what was the point of the CIA team, rather than just to be this gang of strange characters just thrown in the mix, and particularly after the dinner, and you've got Hudson and Anna back at Anna's house, and again the CIA team's waiting outside, and then there's a gag where Butterfingers asks if they want him to go in and rape them. I'm thinking, that's just icky, dude.
Yeah, I know. That's, again, a tone change.
But then they follow it. They tell him to read his book, and he starts reading a Dr. Seuss book, just right on the back of that.
What it was?
Like, yeah. I think he was reading Green Eggs and Ham, to be honest.
I couldn't even make it out or what he was reading. It just looked like a red book to me. But yeah, I thought that was quite strange. You know, total strange in tone. And again, I mean, a change in tone. And you think, was this another attempt by one of the cast members of throwing in what they thought was a witty line? But anyway, it then went back to, thankfully, or moved on.
yeah, moved on. Andy, they're all taken off by the CIA to bad guys in Da Vinci's workshop that we saw from the fairy tale narration at the start of the movie.
Yay, a tie into the opening scene. Yay. Sorry, I'd wanted it the whole time.
Yeah, and he pretty much point blank refuses, I suppose, to do the next caper in stealing this, what was it, a model helicopter or something?
Yeah,
from Da Vinci's work. And yeah, it just goes from place to place, and then they end up Kit Kat escorts Andy McDowell out, dressed as her, and imitating her.
Yeah, that was weird too.
Weird. To try to convince Bruce Willis, they basically knock him out and take him back to the supervillain lair, where he gets a hood on his head, he escapes his confines, and there's Tommy, working with the Mayflowers. Oh no!
But he's really, like, again, I don't know, I think it just felt like we hadn't seen him for a while too, and it's like, oh, he's finally back. And but you know how I said earlier about how they really had that good chemistry, it was good to actually see him again, because you're like, hey, it's like the buddy film, they've finally been reunited again, even though you sort of had gone in so many different tangents since we last saw him.
Yeah, and I do kind of like how the Mayflowers left them to it, and they're out sitting on the balcony and talking about, you know, oh, they'll get along, they'll hug it out, and, you know, Hudson will come around, and suddenly they both come crashing through the window, wrestling with the gun and falling to the steps down below. And when the gun goes off and Tommy's apparently shot, suddenly there's ambulance and police just turn up at that very, very second to bundle them up and take them away, and the bad guys just sit there going, oh, okay then.
Probably because it all happened so quickly. Yeah, but it's like they probably already realise at this point in the movie that anything can happen now.
Pretty much. Well, the ambulance goes into the back of a truck with a gigantic Vatican symbol on the back. And a bit later on, the back of the truck opens and out steps Tommy, perfectly fine, chatting away with Hudson, and there's Andy, and then, the chemistry between Bruce Willis and Danny Aiello, it's like plain to see. They just play off each other, and it works. You can't deny that buddy side of it works well.
And it's almost a shame that they couldn't have built more of a movie around sort of that buddy element, or that, you know, that existing friendship, rather than sort of what it became, because that sort of, you know, the film obviously went off on so many different tangents and other sort of ways, because, yeah, it could have really made a really cool, fun, buddy cop film, possibly, but, yeah, again, Hudson Hawk is a totally different thing.
It is. So they think they've escaped, not realising that the ambulance had Vatican plates, so they thought they were safe back at Andy's house, where Bruce finds out that Andy's really a nun, a spy nun or something.
Yeah, that was weird, yeah.
when the CIA guys come in and manage to paralyse them all before heading off and planting bombs, and the CIA is so incompetent that they manage to, as you said, the head explosion, they one of them manages to get a bomb planted on his own head.
Yes, they are that stupid. But we didn't doubt it. We knew they'd do silly things like this.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And, of course, Hudson and Tommy manage to get unparalyzed enough to jump out the window before everything explodes.
Just in the nick of time, because that's just how this movie rolls. Everything seems to just work for them in the nick of time.
Very much so. And what we got after that, I think, was probably the funniest scene from Mandy McDowell, where she's acting all dazed and just saying all these really weird things, and they think it's a side effect of the paralyzing agent that was used, and she suddenly has this bit where she's going, who knows? Mr. Dolphin knows? Yeah, he starts making dolphin noises. I mean, that just, I found that genuinely funny.
It was just so, yeah, it was so mad. But it's just so unexpected. But yeah, again, you know, it's not, she was probably having a lot of fun with that too. But in a movie that we'd already seen so many different things happen, you didn't, you know, Andy McDowell making dolphin noises didn't really seem out of place, believe it or not.
No, not at all. And so that's where Minerva Mayflower leans in and says, oh, Hudson, go boom boom, and you see the concern in Andy's face, and oh no, she's acting, but whatever. And yeah, then Tommy and Hudson turn up at the castle, take out a couple of guards, and work out how long it's going to take them to rescue Anna. And they just go, okay, let's go blow things up and sing at the same time, because that's really stealthy.
And let's bring in that thing, that plot element that we had like an hour and a half ago. It's a shame, because yeah, again, that's another thing that's kind of really kind of a clever thing that they could have done with, and again showing that real camaraderie between the two actors or the two characters. But again, I shouldn't have expected more from this movie at this stage, so again, just another one of those things thrown back in for us to reference.
Indeed. Yeah, so most of the CIA team goes out to investigate the explosion, leaving Kit Kat to look after Anna and the Minervas, and the Minervas quickly double-cross Kit Kat, who meets an untimely demise, and flicks a little card at the last minute as he unties some of Andy's binding, saying, I always liked you, and is gone.
He's going, wasn't expecting that, but yeah, again, another thing I've got in there, but yeah. Oh, at least it was true to the character.
Yeah.
But then you want to watch it again and just see the whole time, oh, was he giving her the eye? Oh, no, maybe not.
No, and it's not long after that Butterfingers also gets got with a crossbow, and I felt no remorse at all about the CIA team being betrayed and taken out of the equation, because, frankly, I didn't really enjoy many of their appearances.
Yeah, it's almost like they should have got those arrows earlier, maybe. So it's maybe the actors were friends of the director or something, or the scriptwriter, and they said, just can you write in three characters and try to use them somehow?
Yeah, but then, like, the James Coburn character, George Kaplan, even though, you know, he sees Butterfingers come out full of arrows, he still seems to stay on side with the Minervas, and when he confronts Hudson in a rather flamboyant fight scene, you know, he's obviously still very much on side, even though his entire team has been taken out by these extremely insane bad guys.
Oh, I know, and it's like, and it seems like the stage of the movie, just so much was happening, it was just so hard to keep up with it all, as they're trying to tie up everything that they've kind of thrown in over the last hour and a half.
I don't know, but it was also about this time that, the other decent line from Andy McDowell happened after she gets loose and makes a break for it and comes across Hudson, and he's there going, "We're coming to save you," and she just goes, "I got bored, so I saved myself."
And it's kind of like reinforcing, you know, earlier when he first rescued her, it was almost like, "Oh, you're my hero." It's all in a day's work for her. So she just kind of, indeed. Yeah, she's playing the playing the flippant heroine, I think. So,
but even that gets turned around again in Strange Things. But we get a bit more drama as Tommy gets caught by the bad guy with the swords and locked in the back of the car with Darwin Mayflower, the English guy, and Darwin both bail as Tommy's trapped inside. It goes over a cliff and explodes into a ball of flame. Oh no!
Because I just love the explosions in this movie. They have to have another one.
and Hudson and Anna look sad for a grand total of about 2 seconds, and they're concerned that Tommy might have been blown up. But again, their escape doesn't go too well. They quickly get caught up again and get taken to the top of the tower where the Mayflowers can't put these pieces of the star, which is what they were looking for through the entire movie. We probably should have mentioned that earlier. They can't put it together.
Yeah, I know. But again, a reference to the opening scene.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, you know, Richard just doesn't give up. He just keeps giving his all from that quote we had earlier, from what he knew was an awful, awful role.
But yeah, they're still camping it up at the very end, hoping that they can salvage what is left of the movie at this stage.
So, yep, so of course, Hudson decides to put the star together for them, but not completely. So, yeah, when everything goes kaboom and the machine starts exploding, they just get got. They're just suddenly there, and then they're covered in molten metal and bye-bye Mayflowers.
Yeah, and just sort of like hardened up against the wall and stuff. Yeah, very, very dramatic. But I suppose, honestly, if they had turned around and done the most dramatic death scene ever, it wouldn't have seemed out of place with their characters or this movie.
Yeah, you think given how much camping up and just scenery chewing they had done done up to that point, they could have at least got one last flamboyant death scene, but
yeah, or one last cough and one last grab when you think they're dead. But it didn't get enough thinking. They didn't think it through enough. It was still dramatic in some way.
Yeah, so they still got to deal with the British dude with the swords, who they get quite a fight scene, and he sort of goes, you know, "This one's yours." "What? I just did the Mayflowers." "Oh no," you know, more witty back and forth. which led to quite the graphic decapitation, really. I mean, no blood spurts, but still.
Oh, I know. But as we've established early on, they don't seem to hold back with their fight scenes and their explosions and things, so yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that just leaves them to deal with the Mayflower's pet dog. What was the dog's name?
Oh, that was hilarious.
Bunny the dog.
Because we knew that we knew he liked chasing after his ball all the time, but we didn't know he was that ferocious. I don't think I'd noticed it before that. I don't think that was a big reveal, wasn't it?
Bunny, ball. yeah, so Andy says she'll take the dog, and the dog proceeds to just knock it to the floor and start, you know, going for a throat. Incidentally, just as a little callback, just looking at the dog's name here, the dog was played by Frank Welker, who we also know as the voice of the Anaconda from last week's. Not the last episode.
Oh, are you serious? That's so serious. Funny. Oh, God. We have tied them in pretty well, haven't we?
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, no. So he's done a lot of good movies.
He does. He certainly has. Oh, a voice actor, I suppose.
The demise of the dog was just hilarious.
Bruce heads over to a tennis ball machine, which, again, was something that they just had in the castle earlier for no apparent reason. And you go, "Bunny, ball.
Bubble." Just so they can establish it for later.
Yep. And as a tennis ball goes at a high speed, the dog catches it and gets pitched out a window.
Yeah, even though, yeah, I know it was kind of cruel, but yeah, I couldn't help but laugh a bit about that one. So hey, it's one of the villains as well.
Yep.
He saw his demise.
Indeed. So the And to escape the exploding castle, they hop into Leonardo da Vinci's glider and glide out the window, which was, again, something we saw at the start of the movie during the opening sequence in the fairy tale book section. Again, coming around to round things out at the other end.
Yeah, and I kind of, it was good that they finally did sort of tie that stuff in, and I think it was this, it was from there that they then, you know, closed the storybook, and I think we're then finally seeing that he, oh no, sorry, that's right, he gets, they lands in that town, and he finally gets his cappuccino. I'd forgotten about that.
He does, as he comes in, and we get reunited with Tommy, who has just the most ridiculously convoluted story about how he survived this car going off a cliff and exploding into a ball of flame. It's like, yeah. And, yep, Bruce Willis finally gets his cappuccino.
But at the same time, too, it just, again, in a movie like this, it filled out every cliche.
Yep, and we get the narrator back. It goes back to, like, the storybook format, and the narrator has nothing to do with the movie whatsoever, aside from just narrating the opening and closing, sees us out to fade when we get to hear the original version of Swinging on a Star,
which we have heard a few times throughout. But I think, yeah, I think all the versions we'd been hearing had, we've obviously heard reference of it. But yeah, I think by then it had become quite an earworm to me. But yeah, it's by then I was, you know, once the movie was finished, I was still sort of scratching my head about what I had just seen in terms of there was so much to take in.
It's one of those movies where, again, yeah, everything was thrown at the wall. But I will say, with regards to the closing music, as Swinging on a Star fades out and the music, which I was just like straight out thinking, is this porn music? Started up. And then I realized it was something even more disturbing. It was an actual Hudson Hawk theme song. And yeah, I'm thinking,
and there was probably a soundtrack even.
Yeah, I dare say there was, but it's like, I had to keep listening to the song because I've got to watch to the end of the credits.
I know. Oh dear. I know. I wasn't expecting a stinger, but actually from that movie, if there was one, I wouldn't have been surprised because anything could happen.
Very, very true. And, we've got to the closing credits there, Christian. Do you have anything else you would like to say about the movie before we move on?
Oh my God, it's exhausting. No, I feel like I've summed up everything, and God, I'm still coming to terms with a lot of what I saw because it was just very fast-paced and a lot to take in. But yeah, it's good to be able to hear another opinion. But I'm sure there's people out there that are obsessed with this film, possibly, or
quite possibly. We'll get to them in good time. But I think before we get there, Christian, I picked this movie, so as custom dictates, I shall let you go first, and I need to ask you the question, was there anything redeemable about this movie, and was it a redeemable movie overall?
Okay, it's good having a breaking it up like that. So in terms of, does this movie have any redeeming features? Now, I say definitely yes. Now, I've mentioned a lot of times in the podcast about how, you know, the fast pacing and the editing and such a great cast list. But I think the secret with this is it held your attention the whole time. Fair enough, by the second half, you were getting to the stage where you were kind of, you know, scratching your head wondering what was happening next. But having remembered that, you know, this is very much of the madcap comedy capo genre or the real sort of buddy film slapstick movie, it very much fitted that sort of style. But I actually think, you know, the fast pace and the whole fact, I don't know if I can say this, but it was very batshit crazy, let's just say, and full of all those references, that definitely made it redeemable. It just seemed to, it didn't hold back in being just crazy from the outset, and I think that was really, even though we say the tone was quite different in a lot of scenes, I think it was just sort of went with the fact that this is the kind of film that it is. Now, that's definitely sort of the redeeming features, but without sort of trying to touch on, you know, is it a redeemable movie, I definitely would say, Trevor, it is a redeemable movie. I would happily watch this movie again. I'm not saying that it's, you know, one of the greatest movies I've ever seen, but it had enough in it to make me go, wow, I want to go back one day, you know, not anytime soon, but, you know, one day I will go back and watch this film. I want to see, I want to take note of some of the visual gags, some of the references to other movies, and some things that I might not have missed the first time around and could probably appreciate with a second viewing, because I think it's there. I think the whole, we said storybook, but I think it's got that real storybook with the villains and the good guys, and I think it really has that underneath, and it was just a fortunate that it was pieced together with so many bad sort of ideas. So it was tongue-in-cheek, and I did find myself actually laughing out loud in many spots, you know, even if it was probably very more at its ridiculousness. But yeah, so Trevor, I, you know, without saying too much more, I think, I mean, I definitely say this is a redeemable movie, and it has redeemable features. So there we go.
Fantastic. I'm glad you enjoyed. Now, my thoughts on this. Now,
okay.
I'll probably preface this that when I first saw this movie, I think I felt much the same way. So I'm guessing where I'm coming from is going back and revisiting it as a reviewing quite a few years down the track, where I guess a lot of what was in there had faded and only a few core memories remain. So, but definitely from the start, I mean, it could make up its mind. That was one thing that did kind of bug me through this watching of it. I mean, was it meant to be a screwball comedy, a comical crime thriller, or even a dramas in places? I'm not even too sure if the makers knew. The chemistry between Bruce Willis and Danny Aiello, though, was superb. Those two just obviously got on very, very well and had a good time making the movie. I mean, the chemistry between Andy McDowell and Bruce Willis was a bit there, even though their whole budding relationship never really was all that convincing and definitely failed when compared to the bromance between Bruce and Danny. Richard E. Grant and Sarah Bernhardt, I mean, they didn't hold back. There was so much scenery chewing, and they both looked like they were having way too much fun. When you look at this in context of the rest of the movie, they just went for it. The CIA team, they just seemed completely unnecessary, given how pointless and useless most of their appearances were. I think they were simply put in there to make the insane bad guys look even worse when the inevitable double cross happened. But, you know, there was no need to make the bad guys look worse, so even their dying was just pretty much as pointless as the rest of the time they were there. Andy McDowell, look, honestly, I can take or leave her. I usually find her a bit insipid for my taste, but, you know, she got some good laughs out of me through this movie, and I'm kind of just wondering if that's in comparison to her normal performances or in comparison to how I felt through a lot of the rest of this movie. Really, I think the first time I watched this movie, I found it to be a stupidly fun movie. Rewatching it, the fun seems to have faded, and the stupid has come more to the top. I think there's just too many ideas, too many attempts at trying to be clever that didn't quite get there. So many attempts at like, while there were laughs, there were certainly plenty of jokes which fell flat, and I think that all got in the way of what this movie was actually trying to be. So, Christian, again, revisiting it, I'm thinking it's a movie that maybe is best kept in the nostalgic memory, because watching it, I could not find it redeemable. It just was too stupid and too dumb and too uneven. So, yeah, unfortunately, not redeemable.
Oh, well, a bit of a split down the middle then. Oh, that's interesting, Trevor. So maybe it is one of those films you need to only watch once, because any further viewings will just ruin it. So, oh, okay. So maybe I don't need to watch it ever again. I don't. So yeah, interesting to hear your point of view. So I suppose we've got to have those two differing opinions. So it gives us a, something to work off.
Yeah, but hey, look. Like I said, I never begrudge anyone for enjoying a movie. I mean, that's what they're
doing. Oh, definitely. So, you know, and it sounds like, you know, we'll find different things in a movie that something might appeal to one person and whilst, you know, something else might appeal to another. So I'm glad one of us could redeem it.
Absolutely. And of course, as mentioned earlier, this movie does have its fans. And since we do like to finish up our chat about a movie on a positive note, I headed back to Amazon and I've dug up another review. The title of this review is Look Up Surreal in the Dictionary. It says, See Hudson Hawk. I didn't see this movie until quite recently, since I took the critics at their word that it was meant to be awful. I wouldn't have seen it if a friend hadn't insisted. About 20 minutes into it, we looked at each other and said, This is a spoof, right? And it is. Once we figured that out, and our brain stopped hurting from all the plot twists, we had the best time. We laughed until our ribs hurt. This movie is gloriously surreal. Almost no one is who they are or what they seem, except for the insane people. And the comic touches are inspired. Timing burglary by pop standards? The filmmakers saw the top and simply used it as a springboard for bigger and better wackiness. Any film which cast Sandra Bernhard as a gold-plated billionaire out for world domination is simply not taking itself too seriously. Not everyone will like this film. In fact, I'm pretty sure many people will hate this film. But if you thrive on strangeness and sheer fun, rent it, buy it, watch it. 5 stars.
Oh, I wouldn't go that far, but it's good to know that, yeah, it's good to know that they exist. But yeah, but as that reviewer said, yeah, once you sort of realise that it is going for that tongue-in-cheek sort of angle, you can appreciate it a lot more, but it is still crazy.
I will agree with the crazy. There's no doubt about that.
Okay, Trevor, I suppose it's time to lead on from Hudson Hawk to our next movie. And it's funny that, as you mentioned, the last reviewer saying that Hudson Hawk was surreal, because I kind of think the movie that I've chosen next sort of does fit a bit into that category as well. Oh. Something a bit different. As I said, I always go off a bit of a list that, of things that I might not have seen for a while or things that, that would be a really good suggestion. I thought maybe it's time we went back a little bit further. It's been a while since we've gone back to something, say as far back as the 60s. It's probably been a while. So I thought this is a chance for me to have a chance of getting through this movie. I have tried many times. It's just a lot to take in. So we go from surreal. We also go from an ensemble movie such as Hudson Hawk, I suppose you could say it is. And we're looking at a movie from 1968. It was actually made at the height of the psychedelic late 60s. It's actually been referred to as an acid comedy. It features such actors that were big in the time, such as Carol Channing, Frankie Avalon, Jackie Gleason, Mickey Rooney, and Groucho Marx playing God, who actually takes LSD on screen. We're going back to the 1968 acid comedy Skidoo by Otto Preminger, which is actually so obscure of a movie, I don't think many people would have actually heard of it. It's even been suppressed even by the director himself. So I'm really interested to be able to finally get through this movie because I actually think it's as insane as Hudson Hawk.
Wow, Skidoo. I am unfamiliar with this movie, even though the description of it seems tantalizingly familiar, so I may have come across references of it previously.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's very much very that psychedelic 60s, but yeah, where anything goes. But I'm looking forward to actually finally getting through the whole movie because I've never been successful in that, so I don't know if that says a lot about about this movie featuring possibly one of the oddest casts of the time. So I'm looking forward to watching Skidoo and seeing what you think, Trevor.
You saying you've had trouble, you've never been able to get through it. I don't know if that's the best, most positive sign for it, but I'm always game. So yeah, absolutely. I will happily go back to 1968 and watch a stoned out of his mind Groucho Marx play God. How can I say no to that?
Of course. God, it even sounds like we've been talking about a Kevin Smith movie or something, but yeah. So yeah, looking forward to the thoughts on that, Trevor.
Fantastic. So. And of course, if anyone out there would like to share their thoughts, we would love to hear from you. Do you think we were too generous on Hudson Hawk? Do you think we were too harsh? Do you have any comment at all about this psychedelic trip that Christian will be sending us all on with Skidoo? We would love to hear from you. It's super duper easy. You can head to our homepage, rufusproject.com, and leave a comment below this very episode. You can find the Rufus Project on Twitter or Facebook, or of course you can send us an email to podcast@rufusproject.com. If you have come across this, you can subscribe to our podcast by finding the Rufus Project podcast. Gotta be very specific about that. We had an old feed, which is now no longer a going concern. You can find that by having a search through iTunes or your favorite podcast player. We would love to hear from you, and we would love it if you chose to subscribe and perhaps even review us on any of those wonderful podcast services.
So, and there's plenty of chances to be able to recommend movies and listen to some of the other ones that we've attempted to redeem as well, because there's plenty that have been we've managed to tackle.
Absolutely. I'm still not too sure what to think of Skidoo, but I will...
I've seen bits of it, and I still don't know what to make of it, and I love that kind of... those psychedelic movies, so I'm really interested, Trevor, to see how you go. It has recently been released on Blu-ray, so it's been nicely remastered in all its psychedelic glory.
Oh, lovely. Well, I can safely say we will be approaching this with absolutely no expectations, because I've got no idea what's going to be going on, so that's all good.
That sounds like the secret, I think, with the podcast. And even if the movies aren't any good, Trevor, I always know that our conversation is a lot of fun.
Absolutely. Good, bad, or somewhere in between, at least we've got the actual redeeming features cast to have fun with what we've been through.
For sure.
Absolutely. So, until next time, and after we watch Skidoo, I'll chat to you next time.
Yeah, there might not be a next time. Well, all the best with it, Trevor. I look forward to chatting Skidoo with you in a couple of weeks.
Fantastic.
Too good to be bad, so bad it's good. What's this movie? Do you think we should? Got bad, I love dodgy creatures, but we want to know what the redeeming features.
Boy? Oh boy.
Christian and Trevor on the case, watching movies from all over the place. IMDb says it's bad, but we want to know, is it fun to be had?
Boy? Oh boy.
Redeeming features.
Carry moonbeams home in a jar and be better off than you are. Oh, won't you rather be a mule? A mule is an animal with long funny ears. He kicks up at anything he hears. By the way, if you hate to go to school,
you may grow up to be a mule.